I want you to picture the opening scene of a biography. You know, usually you start with the birth, maybe a pivotal childhood moment, something warm.
That's standard. You establish the hero before you break them.
Right. But the story we're looking at today decides to do, well, pretty much the exact opposite of that.
But I mean, it's a high-stakes standoff from the word go.
It is. You are Frank Abagnale Jr. You're cornered at an airport. The FBI has guns drawn. It is, by all accounts, the end of the line.
Nowhere to run.
But instead of surrendering or panicking, Frank does something completely left field. He turns to the agent and says, "Hey, let's make a deal. I'll tell you everything, but you have to let me tell my story to the audience first."
And just like that, boom, the fourth wall shatters. The airport set just dissolves, the lights come up, and suddenly we're in a 1960s television variety show.
It's such a wild pivot. And that is exactly what we are unpacking today. We are doing a deep dive into the musical adaptation of Catch Me If You Can.
Most people know the 2002 Spielberg movie. You've got DiCaprio, Tom Hanks. It was a huge hit.
A classic cat and mouse chase, for sure. But the musical version, that's a much more complicated beast.
And a fascinating case study in how Broadway works. Because on paper, this show should have been the biggest hit of the decade. I mean, the pedigree was almost impossible to beat.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This wasn't some random creative team. This was the reunion of the dream team that created Hairspray.
That is the key context. You had Terrence McNally writing the book, Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman doing music and lyrics.
Jack O'Brien directing, Jerry Mitchell choreographing.
So when Catch Me If You Can was announced, the industry didn't just expect it to be good. They expected Hairspray 2.0.
The bar was set at masterpiece. But as we're going to find out, recreating that kind of magic is, well, it's incredibly difficult.
So that's our mission for this deep dive.
Exactly. We want to explore how this hit movie and autobiography became a Tony-nominated musical that just totally polarized critics. Was it a sheer delight, like the Huffington Post said?
Or was it, as the New York Times brutally put it, just elevator music?
It really is a bit of a mystery. And to solve it, we've pulled together everything from original production notes and 2011 reviews to casting records that span from Broadway to a very, very surprising production in Japan.
Okay, so let's start with that concept you mentioned, the variety show.
Yeah.
Because that's a huge departure from the movie.
Yeah, the movie feels so grounded. Slick, but grounded. Why turn it into a TV special?
Well, it comes down to the framing device. The writers needed a way to get inside Frank's head on stage. In a movie, you can just do a close-up, right?
Sure.
On stage, you need a metaphor. So the show opens with a number called Live in Living Color.
Which is a great title, by the way.
It is. And it establishes Frank not just as a character, but as the master of ceremonies for his own life.
Mm.
He tells the audience, and he tells the FBI agent, Carl Hanratty, that for the next 2 hours, they're watching the Frank Abagnale Jr. show.
So he is curating his own narrative in real time.
Precisely. Oh. And this choice dictated all the music. This is where we run into a term that pops up a lot in the reviews.
Mm.
Pastiche.
Pastiche.
Yeah.
Okay, let's break that down.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that can be used as a compliment or, you know, an insult.
That's a very distinct distinction to make. Yeah. Pastiche just means you're imitating the style of another work or another period. So in Hairspray, Shaiman and Whitman wrote pastiche of Motown.
And it worked. That music is so visceral. It has that heavy backbeat.
You feel it in your chest. Yeah. But for Catch Me, they decided to mimic the sound of 1960s television specials. So think Dean Martin, Mitch Miller, that kind of breezy lounge singer swing.
It's TV special music.
Yes. And the argument for it was intellectual. Frank's a con man wearing a mask, so the music should sound like a mask. It should sound like a performance.
But the risk, and I'm guessing this is what the critics latched onto.
Uh-huh. The risk is that it creates emotional distance.
Because if the main character is always performing, do we ever actually get to see who he really is?
That is the central tension of the show. Are we watching Frank or are we watching Frank playing Frank?
Let's get into the actual story he's telling then. Because underneath all the glitz and the chorus girls, the origin story is surprisingly dark.
It's a classic anti-hero setup, really. We flash back to New Rochelle, New York. We meet Frank's parents, Frank Sr. and Paula. And their backstory is like something out of a movie.
Right. They met in France during World War II. He was a soldier. She was a performer.
The American dream. The war hero and the French beauty. But then the dream runs out of money. By the 1960s, the family is struggling. Frank Sr. is cutting corners. And eventually, Paula wants a divorce.
And Frank is just a kid stuck in the middle of it all.
He's a teenager watching his world collapse. He's literally in a courtroom while they fight over custody. And that is the inciting incident. The song is called Someone Else's Skin.
Such a telling title. He doesn't just run away to be free. He runs away to stop being Frank Abagnale Jr., the kid with the broken home.
Exactly. He decides that if his reality is painful, he'll invent a new one. He wants to be anyone but himself.
And this kicks off the spree. The musical uses that variety show format to frame each fake identity like a different act in his show.
Right. So let's talk about the pilot act. That's the iconic image, the Pan Am uniform.
The song is Jet Set. And it captures the glamour, right? It's not just about flying planes. It's about the stewardesses, their respect.
It is, but there's a line in this section that I think is the skeleton key for the entire musical. He's quoting his father, Frank Sr.
What's the line?
The pinstripes are all that they see.
The pinstripes are all that they see. Wow. That's social engineering 101, isn't it?
It's deep cynicism wrapped in charm. Frank Sr. teaches his son that authority is just a costume. You wear the right uniform, people won't look at the person inside. They trust the symbol, not the man.
And Frank Jr. just takes that advice and sprints with it. He realizes he can hack the social system just by dressing the part.
But the show makes it clear that high doesn't last. The jet set life is lonely. You can't have real friends if you're living a lie. So he pivots. He goes to Atlanta and becomes a pediatrician.
Which, looking back, is terrifying. A teenager playing doctor.
Well, the song is Doctor's Orders. And it's mostly because he needs a job and a place to sleep. But then he pivots again. He goes to New Orleans and decides to become a lawyer to impress a girl.
Okay, let's talk about the girl. This is Brenda Strong.
Right. Brenda is a nurse. And Frank falls for her hard. But the interesting thing is why he falls for her. Mm. It's not just, you know, a physical thing.
It's her family, isn't it?
It is. Her parents are the anti-Abagnales. They're this traditional, stable, kind of boring Southern family.
The song is literally called Our Family Tree.
It is. And for Frank, that song represents the Holy Grail. He's not scamming them for money. He is trying to con his way into a functional family to replace what he lost.
Well, but of course, you can't have a crime spree without a cop.
Mm-hmm.
Enter FBI agent Carl Hanratty.
The man in the fedora. Now, in the movie, Tom Hanks plays Hanratty as this very dry, no-nonsense guy. But in the musical, thanks to the actor Norbert Leo Butz, he becomes something else entirely.
I was looking at the awards for 2011. Bajits won the Tony for Best Actor in a Musical for this role. He actually beat Aaron Tveit, who was playing Frank.
He was a powerhouse. And his performance highlights an insight that I think is crucial here. On the surface, it's a chase story, cat and mouse, but emotionally, it's a story about two incredibly lonely men who are mirror images of each other.
Wait, unpack that. Frank is lonely, sure, he's a runaway, but Hanratty, he's the establishment.
But who does Hanratty go home to?
Nobody.
Exactly. The work is all he has. He's a workaholic. There's this pivotal scene in Act One around Christmas. Frank's at a party, but he feels totally isolated. So who does he call?
He calls the guy chasing him.
He calls the FBI office. Hanratty picks up. And in that call, they both realize neither of them has anyone to spend Christmas with.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
It leads to the duet My Favorite Time of Year. And it's this cynical, funny, but deeply sad song about hating the holidays because they remind you you're alone.
So the chaser and the runner are the only two people who actually understand each other.
It evolves into a surrogate fatherhood. Frank Sr., the biological dad, is charming but tragic. He's an alcoholic. His life's falling apart. Hanratty becomes the stable force Frank needs, the strict dad, but he's the one who's there.
So you have this incredible emotional core.
Mm-hmm.
You have Aaron Tveit launching his career. You have Norbert Leo Butz winning a Tony. You have the Hairspray team. Why didn't this show run for 10 years?
Well, it comes back to that tonal whiplash we talked about. Think about what we just discussed. Abandonment, divorce, loneliness, a father drinking himself to death.
Heavy stuff.
Now wrap all of that in a shiny Dean Martin-style variety show package with high-kicking chorus girls.
I see. It's fighting itself.
That was the main critique. Variety said the show lacked the sly fun of Hairspray and that the TV concept was confusing. Like, why is he doing a TV show about his dad dying? It just felt jarring.
And the New York Times, you mentioned they called it elevator music.
Ben Brantley was pretty harsh. He felt that the pastiche sound made the music feel like audiovisual aids. He actually used the word chalky.
Chalky. Wow, that's a visceral word. It implies dry and tasteless.
It implies it had no nutritional value. And USA Today brought up another really interesting point. They said it's hard to root for a liar in a musical.
Right. The I Want song is sacred in musical theater.
Exactly. But if Frank is constantly performing a fake persona, The pilot, the doctor, the audience doesn't know if they're hearing the truth or just another con. It makes it hard to invest.
So it opens, plays about 170 performances, and closes. By Broadway standards, especially for this team, that's a flop.
Commercially, yes. It didn't recoup. But, and this is why we do these deep dives, the story doesn't end there. The show found this really interesting afterlife overseas.
I saw that. It went to South Korea with K-pop stars, Australia, Germany. But the one that really jumped out at me was Japan.
The Takara Azuka Review. This is a fascinating cultural pivot.
Okay, for those who don't know, what is the Takara Azuka Review?
It's a legendary all-female musical theater troupe in Japan. It's a huge institution.
Wait, so Frank and Ratty the dad, everyone is played by women?
Every single role. In 2015, they staged a production where the star Yuzuru Kuranai played Frank, and Hiroki Nanami played Hanaratti.
That sounds incredible. But does that change the vibe? Because we just talked about how the fake aspect hurt the Broadway run.
In a way, the Takara Azuka production actually solves the pastiche problem. Takara Azuka is already an extremely stylized art form. It's all about heightened performance, glamour, presentation.
So the artifice is the point.
Exactly. When you have an all-female cast performing a show about a man performing a variety show about his life, I mean, the layers performance just stack up perfectly. It fits their aesthetic. The fake nature doesn't feel like a distraction. It feels like the point.
I would love to see a recording of that. It sounds like they just leaned into the spectacle.
They definitely embraced the fantasy of it all.
So let's bring it in for a landing. We know Frank gets caught. How does the musical handle that finale?
It stays true to the emotional facts. Frank is cornered. But the climax isn't a shootout. It's a conversation. Hanratty tells Frank the truth he's been running from. His father, Frank Sr., is dead.
And that's the moment the music stops.
That breaks the spell. Frank realizes there's no one left to impress. The pinstripes don't matter anymore. He surrenders. The song is just called Goodbye.
It's a stripping away of all the glitz.
It is. He drops the variety show persona. The game is over.
But then we get the twist. And this is the part that makes Frank Abagnale such an enduring figure, I think. He doesn't just rot in prison.
No. He serves some time, but he gets released early to work for the FBI.
The ultimate pivot. From public enemy number one to employee of the month.
The finale is a number called Strange But True. It shows Frank and Hanratty working together. It resolves that father-son dynamic. Hanratty finally gets to guide Frank's brilliance towards something productive.
And there's that great little button at the end about the bar exam, right?
Oh, this is my favorite detail. Hanratty finally asks him, look, I know you faked everything else, but you actually passed the Louisiana bar exam. How did you do it?
And Frank says,
he just looks at him and says, I studied.
I studied. I love that. It flips the whole script. It proves he wasn't just a scammer. He was genuinely brilliant.
Exactly. The potential was always real, even if the credentials were fake.
You know, looking back at this show, its legacy is really interesting. It failed to be the blockbuster Hairspray was, but today, it might actually be a smarter show about our modern psyche than we gave it credit for.
How do you mean?
Well, think about Frank's core behavior. He felt lonely and insecure, so what did he do? He curated a perfect, glamorous, high-flying version of his life to impress strangers. He turned his life into a performance.
That sounds incredibly familiar.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
In 2011, Instagram was just starting. TikTok didn't exist. But today, living in living color, performing a variety show version of our lives for validation, is basically what everyone does every single day.
We are all curating our own jet set moments.
Exactly. Frank did it with paper checks and Pan Am uniforms. We do it with filters and captions.
Oh.
But the drive is the same. We want people to see the pinstripes so they don't see the person struggling underneath.
Huh. Maybe the show was just 15 years ahead of its time.
It's a provocative thought, isn't it?
Mm.
Are we all just Frank Abagnale carefully editing our broadcast to keep the ratings up? Something to mull over.
And hopefully we don't need the FBI to track us down to find a real connection.
Amen to that. Thanks for diving in with us. We'll catch you next time.